Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Today's episode of The Stacks is brought to you in partnership with Libro FM. Libro FM is a website that lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your independent bookstore without ever leaving your house. You sign on, create an account, and select the bookstore you want to purchase from. It's easy and it's a great way to show a little love to our small businesses that are in need of our support right now. Libro FM has a wide array of books for you to choose from. Plus, if you're not sure what you want to read next, they have a whole slew of curated book lists from booksellers, and I even have a list. So you can check that out at Libro.fm. The best part is listeners of this show get three audiobooks for the price of one by going to Libro.fm and using the code THESTACKS at checkout. With each listen on Libro FM, you can take pride in knowing you're supporting your local bookstore. Welcome back to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I am your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we're doing something a little different. I'm joined by Priya Parker, the author of The Art of Gathering. She's a facilitator and an expert on getting together. And we talk a lot today about how we can gather in more meaningful ways during this time of coronavirus. We also talk about her beautiful book and her brand new podcast called Together Apart, which also looks into specific gatherings during COVID-19. Everything we talk about today can be found in the link in the show notes. Shopping through those links can earn The Stacks a small commission at no cost to you. Plus, shopping through bookshop.org helps support your local bookstores. Okay, now it's time for my conversation with Priya Parker. All right, everybody, I am here with Priya Parker. She is the author of The Art of Gathering. Priya, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
I am thrilled. I have actually read your book twice because I think it's so amazing and just so well done. I love your book. But for people who haven't read it yet or who are curious about what you do, can you tell us a little bit about the book in about 30 seconds or less?
Thank you. Yes. So the book really looks at why some gatherings take off and are transformative and meaningful and memorable, and others don't. And I am a conflict resolution facilitator. I'm not an events planner or have a background in any type of the kind of accoutrements that are typically associated with gathering. And I wrote this book in part to look at all, to expand our notion of what a gathering is, from dinner party to town halls, court proceedings, weddings, funerals, work meetings, and to actually look at the core of how people come together, why they do it, and how anybody can make it meaningful, regardless of who you are.
You're good at that. You're good at explaining your book. I really like that explanation. I feel like you've done it
before.
Did I do it okay?
Does that match your experience?
It was actually better than my experience. You were able to articulate it much better than I could have. But one of the things that I think is really special about your book is that you really have a fleshed out philosophy about how to gather, some rules that we should be putting in place, some ideas, some important things to remember. Like, you know, if you include everybody, then you're not really having a meaningful gathering. It involves exclusion or setting ground rules or letting go of etiquette or inviting in conflict. Like, there's all these little tidbits that you present to the reader. And my question is, did you have all of that philosophy already in place and you were able to just write it down? Or was the process of writing this book kind of taking what you know and actually getting it on paper?
Great question. This book, the DNA of this book is a combination of a facilitator's manual and what I think the best nonfiction is, which is voyeurism into other worlds. And my training is as a facilitator. I still to this day, even though I've, you know, written this book, I think of myself, my primary identity as a group facilitator, even more than a writer. So there's elements in this book that are the core of my training for the last 20 years, which is the training of facilitation. And so ideas like simply know your purpose. Is there a need? Right? Is there a need for this gathering, or are we just doing it, you know, out of obligation? Is an idea from the core of my work, which is a process called sustained dialogue, which is a group process when people are in conflict of whether or not you bring them together after a riot or race on college campuses. And my mentor, Hal Saunders, would always first ask, like, is there a need? Right? The first phase of sustained dialogue is not getting people into the room. The first phase of sustained dialogue is called deciding to engage. And it's this entire process to actually do a diagnosis of, is the best thing in this situation to bring together a dialogue group, or does it need something completely different? And so when I say know the purpose of your dinner party, right. or know the purpose of your work meeting, or know why you're bringing together your what is it this year at your family reunion that you most want to use it for, the kind of the intellectual inheritance comes from multiple fields. But you know, my husband's a writer, and one of the things that he said to me when I was trying to figure out whether and how to do this was, he said, you know, there are plenty of facilitator manuals and no one except you reads them. Right. right. Or unless you're like insider, you know, these kind of geeky, like badly formatted, very good, you know, facilitator manuals. And he said, no one wants to read that unless you're a facilitator. What people want to read is they want to have an excuse to sit on their couch and to go into 42 different worlds. Mm. So if you're going to write this book, like write down, and I have it in one of my files, write down the 40 things you know most to be true about about group dynamics. Hmm. Put them in your language, build out each idea, write it. Some of these are half-baked ideas. You know, some of these are inherited ideas, and some of these you're going to have to figure out through your experience, and then go into 40 different worlds that none of us have time or access to go into, and tell us what a dominatrix thinks about shadow work and power in a gathering. And so he said, you carry the story. The story should carry the idea.
Yeah. Well, that was really good advice, because I feel like that is definitely what makes this book so resonant, is that I felt like I was able to experience other people's gatherings and take ideas from a gathering that I would never attend. You know, I host a podcast and I'm a fitness instructor, so I'm not really going to a meeting of these powerful people at the edge of the world deciding about conflict and all this stuff. Like, that's just not in my wheelhouse. But I was able to take some of that advice and bring it to my dinner parties, you know, that I have for my friends. And so I think that that's fun, because you've encompassed a lot of different things. And I think for anyone, everyone gathers. Everyone is in charge of a gathering at one point or another in their life. And I feel like you've given us a lot of different ways of looking at our gathering, and something's bound to hit for, I think, everybody who picks up this book. So I think that was great advice from your husband.
Hey, he's a good one.
Yeah. And well executed by you.
Thank you. I mean, you know, even part of, because this is a books podcast, it's rare for me to actually kind of geek out and talk about the, how I structured it. But I think one of the things that I tried to find, well, I would say two different things. One is a lot of different types of gatherings that hit different notes and appeal to different types of people. Right. And so gathering, I think, is has been boxed into the feminine. And I think it's actually a deeply integrated. I think it's masculine and feminine. I think it's power and love. I think it's efficiency and productivity and power and impact. But I also think it's nurturing and belonging and community and love. Mm. But which is why I have the New York Times page one meeting, and I analyze that, and I analyze court proceedings in Red Hook, and I spend time with Platon, the photographer, and ask him how he gets, you know, Putin to give him the face that he wants in his portrait, even if he only has 12 minutes with him. Right. But then I also go into all of the everyday gatherings that most of us experience. And that's one, which was the type of gathering I tried to pick, from public to private and everything in between, work, home. But the second thing I tried to do was both go into these kind of fantastical gatherings, like a Cirque du Soleil choreographer, mm-hmm. Michelle Lepree, or like even just out of the ordinary, the end of life, Buddhist monks, mm-hmm. who spend an hour with 1,000 doctors, helping them create the experience of how do you create and nurture people through end of life experiences. But then I also tried to bring in the everyday, like, my stepsister is about to come over, and in 3 minutes, let me scramble and actually set the table. Right. Or that same choreographer. I think it's easy to say this is a specialized skill that other people with either fancy houses or fancy degrees or really high emotional intelligence can do, but that's not for me. And I wanted to break open that belief, because I deeply believe anybody can gather well. Which is why when I interviewed the Cirque du Soleil choreographer, I spent 3 hours on the phone with him describing the intricacies of how he created his last Cirque du Soleil time show. And And then at the very end of the interview, I said, can you just tell me, like, this is beautiful and sophisticated and some of the most amazing work in the world, but most of us are never going to do that. Can you just tell me, like, how you hosted your last gathering, like your own, do you see your friends? Like, what does that look like? And that's the only part of the interview that made it into the book. And what he said was, and it's the Christmas story. He said, I it was the end of the year. I hadn't seen my friends. I was feeling really disjointed. I hadn't even put up a tree yet. And so I shot off an email to 12 friends. I said, I haven't seen you in forever. Come next week. Send me 2 photos of happiness from the last year. And come for a tree dressing. And they walk in, and he had just printed out on his home printer, like 24 photos of their moments of happiness. There's ornaments and cocktails waiting for them, and they decorated the tree together. But it was through the very simple move of asking them to send their 2 moments of happiness, it became this bonding device. You know, oh my gosh, George, what, you know, you're in an acrobat suit. What beautiful legs you have. Or wow, you sold your house this year. Or oh my gosh, where was that scuba diving trip? Right. And so it was, you don't need to be a circus choreographer to be able to ask people to send you 2 photos of happiness and print them out and put them on a table when people walk in.
Right. Right. Yeah. A lot of the examples are really simple things that anyone can do in a lot of the cases. And I think, again, that is what makes the book work for so many different people, is that it's easy stuff. You just have to kind of be thoughtful and open. One of the things that I am very impressed with by you, and I know that you've been doing this work for years and years, so I think some of it comes with practice, but I'm curious what advice you might have for people who are trying to, well, let me rephrase this. One of the things that you do in the book that's so great is that you tell us when people have issues with their gathering, they can't quite figure out what's going on, and you kind of come in and you give them this great advice, or you notice there's a tension in the group and no one's talking about it, and you decide to do a cage match, or these all these little problem-solving things that you do as the facilitator and the person who's hosting the gathering. What advice might you have for the listeners about how they can be open and receptive to the dynamics of their gathering? How can people kind of figure out what their group needs?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is really complicated to figure out what a group needs in the moment.
Right.
Right. Which is why half the book, the first 4 chapters, first 5 chapters, don't even talk about people in the room yet.
Right.
Right. It goes actually back to that deciding to engage phase. And the best way to figure out what a group needs is well before anyone enters the room. And what I mean by that is, say, for example, one of the big ideas in this book is that a gathering starts at the moment of discovery. And that the moment of discovery means the moment that the guest receives some form of invitation for this future promised event. There's going to be a conference on rural America next week. There's going to be the public yoga session for the neighborhood in the park at noon on Saturday. My birthday party is in 2 weeks. Won't you come? Right? There's this future promised event.
Right.
And you're actually hosting your guests from the moment of that invitation all the way up to the moment that they enter the door. And the best way to actually hold a group and have it be great in their moment is ahead of time, tell them what the need and purpose is for this gathering and get them in the mood for it and let them to actually say yes or no. Right? So it's like, it's coups happen or overthrows happen in gatherings, usually because of something that has or hasn't happened before anyone entered the room.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay. So I want to talk about your new podcast called Together Apart. It's by the New York Times, and you're a producer and the host of this show, and it's fantastic. It's brand new. As of recording, I believe there's only 2 episodes, but I want to talk about, you know, gathering in this time of coronavirus, because I think that A, it's on everybody's mind, and B, I think that it's really challenging. So my first question around that is, how did you approach the idea of gathering when you realized what was going on, when you realized people were going to be gathering apart and they were going to be Zooming each other or relying on FaceTime? Like, how did your changing, what was your change or thought process?
Mm-hmm. So we have been working on this show for over a year. This original show, not Together Apart. We had a podcast that has been in the works called Gathering with Priya Parker. It was sort of the little inside tip. It was sort of a gathering makeover show.
Okay.
We looked at all different types of gatherings, real people's lives calling us, me coaching them, and then our producers going into their gatherings and live, you know, recording the actual gathering. We had brides going in and auto, you know, taking,
oh my God,
hitting the voice memo on their weddings to like record certain parts. And it was probably, I saw a tweet, I can't remember, it was probably early March, but it was the night that the NBA canceled the
yes,
season.
It was a Wednesday night.
And, you know, and I'd been watching the South by Southwest conversation and watching these kind of very large gatherings ungather and debate what to do. And, you know, it's funny. I don't know the word gathering has obviously spiked in a crazy way.
Mm.
You know, I can no longer have a Google alert for the word gathering, for example. And I looked at what was happening. And I also noticed that the emails I was getting, from clients, you know, my day job is still as a group conflict resolution facilitator, mm-hmm. helping people have conversations that they need to have that are going to affect the future of a political movement or the future of a company. But the emails I was starting to get is like very practical. Can we move this thing online? Right. The core of your work is honest, transformative, healthy conflict. Do you think we can do that online? To very personal ones. We were going to have our wedding. Do we cancel it? Do we postpone it? I'm a teacher. How do I create the connection you're talking about over Zoom?
Right.
And I saw the writing on the wall and I talked to my producers and I said, look, like this show on gatherings is not going to work in part because we just very simply, it was first logistical. We can't get tape. If people aren't gathering, we can't get
right,
tape.
Right. Of course.
And then you'll see an influential theme here. My husband, you know, was over meals and I was telling him the kind of emails I was getting and he said, why don't you pivot? It's still the same principles. You're still at the core of what you do is you still understand group dynamics. And what I realized, as a group facilitator, what I know how to do is help people find meaningful connection and overcome the obstacles to that connection.
Right.
And my training is in race and ethnicity and identity. In this case, all of that is still true, but now the core obstacle becomes physical, right, and technological. And so we pivoted, and a producer texted me. I saw some of the texts. He said, you know, a show about gathering now sounds like a horror flick. And he was right.
Yeah.
So we pivoted and, you know, about 3 days we sent, my production company is called Magnificent Noise and it's in partnership with the New York Times. And we all had a meeting and they said, go for it. And so what was supposed to be a show that was sort of beautifully and slowly produced over a year and then, you know, dropped over 6 weeks. Once everything had been finalized, you can work with a character for 3 months or 4 months. They plan mm-hmm. a wedding. You talk to them in March. They have their wedding in October. You send tape in October. Then, you know, the entire episode is like beautifully done. We're now producing a weekly show live week to week, live meaning whatever happens that week, right, is the next week's episode.
Right.
And so very simply, Together Apart is a show that explores how people right now are thinking about and actually hosting their gatherings together apart, virtually or through social distance, you know, gatherings. We take one character per episode whose gathering or future gathering has been upended by coronavirus, a canceled wedding, the 40th year of a Passover Seder of 35 people who've been coming for 40 years together, you know, again and again, not being able to actually do it in person. A 17-year-old high school senior whose prom has been canceled, whose graduation has been canceled, and she's about to turn 18, and her older sister, you know, feels awful that she can't even have an 18th birthday party. And every episode explores one person's gathering. It's a coaching call with me. But we take the gathering, as I do in the book, to explore. We use, you know, birthdays to explore, is it okay to still celebrate right now? Mm. We use birthdays to explore questions like, can you still change even if you're in place? What does it mean to create a transition ritual for an 18-year-old if she feels stuck at home? Right. What does it mean for all of us to, are we still changing and growing even if we're physically can't leave our house?
Right.
Where are we in the tunnel? And so like a good book, we're taking every episode as a vessel of a specific gathering in a specific world, baby showers, schools, graduations, funerals, and going into the life of somebody, but then also exploring these underlying gathering questions about groups and power and identity and transition and ritual.
Yeah. And it's a really great show. It comes out on Wednesday, and so does this podcast. And I sometimes have been listening to that before I listen to my own show.
Wow, what an honor.
It's really great. I just really love it. So I think this is something that I have been struggling with myself. So I'm going to ask you for a little personal advice, but how can we, you know, as we do these Zoom gatherings, right? And like, we feel that we're together, but we're really not. And I'm sure everyone has someone in their community that maybe lives alone or is maybe, you know, kind of feeling more distant than normal, or you can kind of get a sense that that person maybe is disengaging. How can we reach out and connect with those people who are more in the fringes of our friends or family circles and who are feeling lonely and sad? Like, what advice might you have to make sure that we're not leaving people out who maybe need the connection? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is one of the most important, urgent questions right now, as we're all not navigating this new normal. You know, a couple of things. First, and just stepping back, not just to those in your community, you know, in sociology, but also in conflict resolution and in organizing and all of these different fields, there's this idea of community mapping. Sometimes it's called power mapping. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's called network mapping. And you literally do it as an exercise. If you go and you take out a piece of paper and you just map all of the communities that you belong to, that you care about, that you need something from, or that you want to give something to. It depends on what you're mapping. But what I would say in this conversation for anyone who's listening is almost like map out your communities of care and map out your communities of responsibility. From whom do I like want to make sure I am still getting fed and staying connected and are sources of light and restoration for me? And then to whom am I obligated? And if, and that last part, and there's, and then within any of those communities, there's different amount, there are different amounts of power and access and privilege. And you can then take another color, another, you know, colored pencil or marker. And if to your question, to then map within those communities, who is most isolated, who is most on the edge, who in my world is most in the at high risk on any of these elements, for loneliness to anything else, to groceries, and then center in on those people and find two or three people that you check in with daily or weekly. And then specifically, so part of this is creating, it's like a post-it. I mean, we are in a moment of massive interruption, and right. I think it's really hard to remember everything, like right. of who to check in on and who. So it's almost, you know, Atul Gawande, the checklist manifesto, like what is your checklist manifesto of responsibility for people? And who are you checking in on? And then I think if, you know, for some people listening there, you know, you may be in a very fortunate position where the relative pain is still pretty relative, still pretty minute. And so you may come to an insight after doing that mapping and make a financial donation to a food bank in your area, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of different ways that one can help, but and then very practically in terms of loneliness, particularly for communities that just have phones. You know, I'm talking with people now who are running senior centers or thinking about aging or thinking about different populations that have less access to technology, and really centering what can you do that is just through listening, right? What are auditory experiences? And so that could be very simply picking up the phone and calling a grandparent or calling somebody in your life and offering them to read three chapters of a book.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I also have questions around obligation. I feel like, especially right now, at least for me, you know, I get these emails from a group of friends and it's like 20 people and we're going to get on a Zoom and just check in. And I'm curious how you think people could maybe gather without that sense of obligation, right? Like that, oh, I have to do it. It's my whole family, or everyone from my graduating class is getting on a phone call and there's a million things I'd rather be doing, including just unplugging right now. What are some ways that people can come up with events or gatherings and make them not feel like just blah?
Yeah.
Because those are just so unspecific. You know, I think that's really what I'm getting at. It's like, yes. How can we make these gatherings specific?
What are we doing here?
Yeah. Why are we here? Why are, like, yeah. There's still that same question of why are we gathering? And what are yes. some maybe like checkpoints that people can think through before they decide to host a online call or whatever it is?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I write a weekly newsletter. I've just started it in part because of this time, about a month ago. And I wrote about this in the last one. And I couched it within birthdays, which is sort of the difference between a, can you come and, you know, come at so-and-so's birthday, you know, 6 p.m. Saturday, whatever it is. And how do you move from what I call performative to meaningful? Mm. How do you move beyond the kind of, hey, how are you? Like, let pointy hats, candles on a cake, wish happy birthday, make a few jokes. And kind of like after a while, it's like, okay, this is sort of awkward.
Right.
Okay. Bye, everybody. Love you. Bye.
Right.
Two, creating a gathering where even if people feel obliged to come, right? I mean, it's part of being in a community is some amount of right. obligation. There's this, I forget her, she's a writer and she gave a talk. She says one element of home is where you experience restraints, which I think is like restrictions, right? So meaning what, so I think to make something meaningful is to actually ask, what is the need here? And so for a birthday party, it could be very simply, what is that birthday person? And we talk about it in the episode. What that year when you're 18 or whether you're 80 or whether you're 25 this year, what is it that you most need from your community? Mm. Is it a sense of release? Is it, are you trying to be distracted or are you trying to be present, right? Do you all sync watch something together? And sort of, I got a comment on Instagram the other day that said it was actually a birthday party. She said, we had a dinner party as a Zoom call. And someone asked the question, what's a place that you are longing for right now, or that you travel, that you would love to travel to? Like, let's make some travel plans. Mm-hmm. And then that was the center of the conversation. At the end, one of the guests said, oh my God, that was such a relief. I forgot about life right now for a couple of hours. And I don't, you know, and I'm not, So the way to make it not feel like an obligation is to make sure wherever you're in your community, this is something that people actually want to do, A, and B, give it structure around a meaning. So I'm hosting with my mother, my stepfather's 80th birthday, actually this Saturday. Hmm. And we had the same issue, you know, our in-person gathering was canceled. What do we do? And one of the things we're doing is we're hosting a Zoom cocktail hour, but in part because it's easier now for people to come, we invited 40 people from all parts of his life in multiple different, you know, cities. And to give him some structure, all we have asked is we ask him to wear some kind of headpiece, okay. To make it festive. And in part because he likes, it could be a hat, it could be a feather, you know, feather right. boa, it could be whatever, but, to bring a story and a wish. Mm. And it's this very simple orienting structure to actually give people something to do. But also to give everybody else on a call a sense of who everyone else is. What's the nature of the bond? What's the nature of the relationship? What side of my father or stepfather or grandfather or husband don't I normally see? And I actually get to see through this person's eyes.
Yeah, that's such a great idea. You're so good at this.
But it's a habit. Anyone can be good at this, right?
It's like practice. And
it's practice. And it's, as you're saying, seeing examples, getting ideas from other people. Right? Like steal these ideas. I mean, you know, use them because we are all hungry for meaning.
Yeah.
You know, I have a Zoom call with I'm half Indian and half white American, and with my Indian family every week. Well, I shouldn't say every week. So for the first time ever because of coronavirus, it's one of the cousins, and we live in five different countries, mostly in India, but in the US, in India and Hong Kong and Australia.
Wow.
And it's three generations of my mother's family. And it was a novelty, and somebody suggested, let's do a Zoom call. And so all three generations, including my grandmother and including my children, so four generations were on the Zoom call. And the first one was just lovely, right? It was getting people on Zoom. It was kind of hilarious to see people. Everybody was talking about where they were, what the situation was. It was really beautiful. Then the next week, we should we do it again? Okay, let's do it again. And then the next week, it was the novelty kind of wore off.
Right.
And a little bit. And then we finally, one person's company actually was deemed essential to Corona. So we kind of finally found our way to like an interesting conversation.
Mm.
And then the next week, no one said, hey guys, we're going to meet on Sunday.
Right.
And I've actually been talking with them about, do we want to just let this be? Or if we wanted to do something to actually create this diasporic family that otherwise sees each other once every two or three years, what could we do? And my cousin came up with this idea. So we're experimenting right now and we're rotating hosts. And some people are like, this is dumb. I'm exhausted. I'm homeschooling my kids. Like, stop it. I'm out. You know, I'm checked out. I'm not going to do this.
Right.
But some people are game. And a cousin of mine took on like hosting as an experiment this week. And his prompt was, we have a WhatsApp thread, share on your family thread a photo from your wedding and come with a memory of it. And it was so simple. It's such a simple idea. But actually what that does is it allows, particularly in an intergenerational call, it allows for people to hear stories from often like weddings they weren't at that they've never heard before, right? It allows people, one person tells a story, but then for the rest of the family who was at that wedding, they start remembering hilarious moments of that wedding, right? It actually becomes this very interesting tribal rite.
Right.
But it's this very simple prompt.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. I'm stealing all of this for my family because we've been having these things. And I know my aunt is listening and probably my mom, and no offense, I love you guys, but they're getting to be tedious.
I mean, another tip, and frankly, you know, people didn't join that call either. I mean, some people did, like we're all struggling with this. And so that at the core of this is like, why are we doing this? Which is the core of every gathering. Why are we doing this? And let's not do anything out of obligation. Let's do it out of need.
Right.
And if it's not, I don't say gather more, I say gather better. And sometimes gathering better means gathering less often.
Right. And I think also another thing that's kind of underlying this is that, again, there is an opportunity in these gatherings if done well. There, like, it sounds like in your family's gathering that there's a sense of you're learning about your family members in a totally different way. And there's this sense of like, oh, I'm getting to understand this part of my grandmother or my cousin or whatever in a way that I normally wouldn't if we were face to face. Because life feels so frozen right now, and you know, every conversation is either what did you have for dinner or did you go on a walk today? Basically, like that's pretty much life right now. That this is opening up kind of like another dimension, this past dimension, if done well, if done with intention.
Well, I was just, speaking of books, there's a scene from Jhumpa Lahiri's Interpreter of Maladies that like I keep thinking about. And have you read do you remember?
I've only read like a few collection of the stories.
Yeah. It's a collection of, she won the Man Booker or the Pulitzer. I can't remember what she won, but it was her debut, you know, book. And one of the short stories was a woman, and it's almost all Indian Americans living in the US, first generation or immigrants. And this is a Indian couple who they were married. I think they lived in Cambridge, Mass, and they just kind of lost each other. Like they lived in the same house. They went through the same routines, but they kind of avoid each other.
Yes,
one was in one room,
one.
The other one, the other. You're right. Yeah. And there was this big storm and there were, you know, a tree fell on a phone line and the electricity goes out and they find one candle and they sit at the table. And the story is basically the nature of them coming together and sitting and having the conversations that they otherwise would never have in the candlelight. And then one day the van pulls up and fixes the tree, the pole and the lights come back on and then they've lost each other again. And so we're in interstitial time right now. And I don't think actually, I think that's how that story ended. They lost each other again. But I think that there's like interruption invites the opportunity for invention.
Yeah. That was my next question for you, which is how do you see us gathering again and kind of renegotiating what we've all gone through as a way to gather? Because I think not only just getting together, but I think there's going to be, at least for me, I can speak fully for myself, I'm freaked out about getting back together with people. I'm scared of actually being in the same rooms with people, even small events or hugs or handshakes or, you know, larger events, concerts or sporting events or, you know, for what you do, these conferences. So how do you, I mean, this is really just asking you to kind of speculate, but what do you see the future of getting back together looking like? And how do you think that people can go about it in a way that feels okay? Like what are some baby steps? Because we are going to get together again in the future, I certainly hope. And at least for me, I'm such an anxious person that the thought of going to dinner is like, I want to go to a restaurant so bad, but I'm also totally freaked out about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I am too. I think that at many, many, many levels, this is a deeply cruel virus. And it's cruel not only in the way that it infects people, but it's cruel in the way that it actually punishes that which we most need.
Right.
And I think that after the, everything that I've been reading, I've been reading David Kessler and listening to him on various podcasts, this expert on grief. And he said recently, you know, even if you haven't lost anybody yet, we are experiencing collective grief. And he defines grief as the marking of loss. And we are currently grieving the world that we knew. Mm-hmm. And when there's predictions that we will no longer shake hands anymore after this, like it breaks my heart. Like we actually need more healthy touch, not less.
Right.
But I think that it will be incremental. And I think there's an opportunity here where while we are apart, we invent ways that actually center meaning versus symbol or performance. Right. Because we have to actually substitute for the loss of all that we get when we get to just physically be together.
Right. Ugh.
And so what I mean by that is we obsess more about the questions we're going to ask rather than the flowers that we might put on the table. Right. We obsess more about the type of conversation that might get unearthed to build community rather than whether ramps are in season.
Right.
And I love ramps and I love food and I love a beautiful meal. And I'm not poo-pooing any of that, but gathering has somehow been squished together with things, right? If you get the food right, if you get the fish knives right, if you get the table setting right, like people will take care of themselves. If you can't control the chemistry, that's literally not true. Right. As a group facilitator, all that you can do is create the right conditions for people to come on their own volition for an identity or for a need that you've identified for a specific moment in time and to create something that didn't exist before.
Right. Okay. I want to talk a little bit more about the book because I kind of got sidetracked on this because I'm sure I'm not alone that it's all I think about. Actually made doing the podcast a little bit harder just because I'm curious how everyone else is living in this time. But I do want to talk a little bit more about the book because it's fantastic and it's out in paperback now and, you know, let's give it a little love. But I'm curious for you, what was the hardest part about writing this book? And then what from this book came easily for you?
Such a great question. The hardest part for me, well, I'd say two things. One was trying to figure out what was obvious to me, but not obvious to other people.
Mm.
I would say that's probably the hardest thing because I want to always honor my reader. I believe in a deeply, at some level, equal relationship and democratic relationship. One of the people I actually interviewed for a book named Daniel is he's a Montessori teacher and he's the one who does the knitting, the throwing the ball of thread across the room that I write about. And he talked about one of the reasons he loves Hillary Mantel. Is that how you say her name?
I don't know.
She's a writer and he says, you know, the reason I love her books is because I feel respected as a reader. And she levels with me. And so I think, sometimes as a, when I was trying to figure out like what's obvious and what's not obvious, I could sometimes skip what I think is obvious and getting way too into the weeds of gathering. And right. And my early readers would say, no, like you're at step five, we need step one. And I'd think like, I actually have to say that? And it's like, yes. And I actually... So that was one. And then I think the second was how quickly to get into the ideas versus to build out the character. Like an early draft, I had, you know, I don't know, probably 4,000 words or 3,000 words written on Zoe Stephanie, the dominatrix slash lawyer I interviewed about her childhood, about her life and, you know, about all, she's such a fascinating character. And then a trusted friend of mine who's an editor read it and he said, like, this is fascinating, but like, I have a dinner party tonight. Like, what does this have to do with the dinner party? I don't know what I, like, how, what I want to know is what can she tell me that I can do differently in 3 hours and make tonight awesome.
Right.
And so then I went back and like actually rewrote the book.
Yeah, that's a really good advice also. Okay. So this is something that we always talk about. It's probably my favorite thing because I'm obsessed with how people do things differently. So I'm curious, what is your writing setup like? Do you have snacks? Do you have beverages? Where are you? Can you write anywhere? Or do you have to be in a specific place? Is there music playing? Can you have the TV on? Like, what is Priya's writing corner look like?
Well, I live in New York City and my life is very modular in an apartment with a husband and two kids, and the husband also works from home. And so one of the things I've learned to do is to create, I'm also, this is getting a little, maybe it's too TMI, but I'm also a child of divorce and spent a lot of time moving back and forth between homes. And so I've gotten very good at creating a little corner wherever I am. And so it's not like I have to be in the same spot of the same house in the same exact thing, but within the space that I'm in, I type on my laptop, but actually I'm a better speaker than I am a writer.
Okay.
And so I wrote a lot of my book by first just recording voice memos to myself and then putting my headphones in and then typing it out and then playing with, I'm a stronger like speaker. Like I kind of figure my ideas out through conversation,
right?
And through talking. And I'm a decent editor.
Got it.
I'm not a great writer. And so I kind of have to hack around. So I generate it through voice memos and then I shape it through editing, if that makes sense.
Right.
And then I always love to have a glass of water. And often a jug. I drink a lot of water, and a hot cup of tea is ideal. And like my mother, I go back and sort of reheat it or keep filling up the tea, you know, multiple times through the day.
Yeah. Is there a specific kind of tea?
I go through phases where I'm obsessed with one type and then I overdo it.
Okay.
So for a time it was Tazo Earl Grey.
Oh, that's my jam. And,
really?
Yes.
So good. Like they just get the bergamot perfect.
It's perfect. Yeah.
It's perfect. And then that was a few years actually. And then I also really like the Tazo chai, the caffeinated version.
Okay. Yeah.
It's like the fast version. If someone's not going to sit and make chai, I really like that. Right now I'm having because it's harder to get stuff right now, I'm having an English breakfast. Okay.
Yes.
But a good strong black tea is always a thrill with some milk in it.
Yeah. You sound like me. I'm literally sitting here drinking black tea with milk right now.
Me too.
Yeah. Okay. What about a word that you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Oh my gosh, that's good. This is a very bizarre, but recently I've been having a mind block. I mean, this isn't a complicated word. I just wave.
Wave.
Like to wave your hand.
Uh-huh.
It's very bizarre. Like it's not a difficult word. It's more like there's something happening in my brain where every time I write it, I have my fingers type out WAIVE and then I have to go delete the I. I don't know. It's very bizarre. Maybe it's something that's going on right now because I never noticed it before.
That's a really good one. I've never had wave before. That's good.
Yeah, it's just like the use. And then I would say surprise. Surprise. Ooh. I often have to, I'm like, is there an R in there? Is there an extra R in there?
Yeah. Totally.
Not complicated words.
No, it's never complicated words. That's what's so great about this question. It's always like the most, you know, benign words that everyone has at least one. I have like 70, but it's fine. So you've said this a few times and I feel like I would be remiss not to ask you this. You say, you know, you're not a writer, you're not a good writer, you're not really, you know, that's not your background. So why write a book? Whose idea was this? What made you decide I'm actually going to sit down and take on this huge endeavor? Because writing a book isn't just, you know, let me just throw this down.
Right.
Like it takes a lot of work and energy. So where did the book idea come from?
So I have been a facilitator I've been doing actively some version of group facilitation or conflict resolution or dialogue for more than 20 years. And about 10 years ago, people started to say, like, you should really train a lot more people. You should build this up into a large organization. Mm-hmm. You know things that other people don't. You are like a different, you're refreshing the idea of what it means to be a facilitator. You should build up an organization around this. And I thought, that sounds exhausting. I don't want to build an organization. I want to facilitate. And then the second thing is, you know, my mother is an anthropologist and she's written a lot of books, all academic, and my husband's a writer and, you know, and I think norms are contagious. And mm-hmm. so I think in part because of the people who I was around, and I thought, I do want to get these ideas more out into the world. And I really believe my deepest hope for this book is that it's a deeply democratic book. And it's that it's an empowering book. And it really lets everybody realize you don't need to be an extrovert. You don't need to be trained in this for years to be able to bring people together in a meaningful way to change something. And so I started toying around with the idea that if I don't want to scale a business, words have power. And could I put this into a form that if it does well, a lot of people could read and what I know could be transferred to them in their context, right? So not necessarily to create 10,000 more facilitators, though I think we need them.
Yeah.
You know, blessed are the peacemakers. But I think that this is a way of seeing the world that we are just not taught. And so I just figured a book just felt like something that was going to be within a lifestyle that I wanted. That the core of the work to me wasn't actually writing it. It was the research and getting to interview 100 different gatherers and talking to them and learning. Like to me, actually the hardest part and the part I hated the most was the writing. I love the research. I love the ideas. I love the idea mapping. I even enjoyed, I actually loved the book tour because I did all of the events as experiences, but I actually, the writing was really, really, really painful, but everything around it was a complete honor to get to do.
I'm glad that you stuck out the writing because it's just such a lovely book to read. And I mean, we don't have to go too much into this because I know that authors always hate when I talk about the cover, but the cover of this book is so stunningly beautiful. And the inside of the book matches that so well. Like it is a moving experience to read the book. I found, do you know if you'll ever write another book? Do you know if you have something coming next?
I just want to honor the artist. The cover is by Helen Yentis.
Yes,
this book is with Riverhead and she's amazing. And the original cover, I hope they don't mind me saying this, was like a table with six chairs. Mm-hmm. And I got the image and I started crying. I mean, not good crying. it wasn't this image. It was like a stock image of like a table and some chairs. And I called them. I said, I don't understand. Like, where's the gorgeous Riverhead cover? And they said, well, that's for our fiction covers. Like, this is a business book. And I said, give me a fiction cover. Mm. And Helen went home and she water painted over the entire weekend. And I got that beautiful image mailed to me Monday morning.
So gorgeous.
It's incredible. And it really does. It embodies what I most wanted people to think that gatherings could be.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is. Right on.
And to answer your other question, we are toying right now with different what next project is. So I think there will be another future struggle in me to get something on the page.
Good.
And right now I really am inspired by all of the ways people are creating and inventing new forms in this moment. And so I'm feeling inspired. I'm, you know, I also go through periods of deep sadness and overwhelm. And the way I navigate it is to, through my little pocket in the world, through my little lens, is to see how can we still do this? How can we still find meaningful connection even while we're apart? And so that helps give some lift to each day.
Yeah, that's good. We all need something that feels a little bit better in these moments.
Yeah.
For people who love your book, what are some other books that you might recommend to them? They don't necessarily need to be about gathering, but just books that you feel like your book is in conversation with or books that you think that they might also enjoy.
Mm-hmm. One is it's a facilitator's book.
Okay.
But it actually goes to what I said at the beginning of this call. It's called Power and Love by Adam Kahane. Okay. He's a facilitator who takes this idea that all forces, it was introduced by a theologian named Paul Tillich, that all groups are defined by two forces, power and love. The desire for people to self-actualize, like to be an individual, to be a self, and love, the desire for the separate to be together, to be in union. And he says that group dynamics are both, and that power without love is abusive, but love without power, like just togetherness without kind of a point or without a, mm-hmm. some force there, is anemic. Hmm. And that book has really deeply helped me as a facilitator. I try to actually read a lot of historical books and parts. So I just recently finished These Truths by Jill Lepore that actually really helps me historically understand how people gathered and how different technologies were crucial and changed the nature of group dynamics. So looking at how, like at the turn of the century, you know, presidential candidates would go and do these almost like tent revival type experiences. And then the introduction of the radio and how FDR used the radio in a way that completely changed the way Americans gathered in the living room. And then how television changed the way people gathered. So I like to have a historical lens. I recently read Dark Money by Jane Mayer. She Said by Megan Toohey and Jodi Kantor. I'm really interested. I try to read books that shed light more on power. That's what's recently been on my bookshelf.
Okay. Those are good. Who is a person, like the coolest person that you know that's expressed interest in your book or that's read your book? For you.
What an interesting question. Let's see. I got an email probably a year ago from the Obama Foundation, from the head of it, and saying like, we're big fans and we're thinking about, this is a really cool book and it's really helping us think about how we do what we're doing. That was neat. This was more like, wow, Brené Brown recently recommended it and just recently was interviewed. What is she reading right now during coronavirus time? And in the Wall Street Journal, someone forwarded it to me and she said, Glennon Doyle's, I think it's Untamed. And Priya Parker's Art of Gathering. I was like, wow.
That's awesome.
I think the people that I, you know, but the emails I most love are from young people around the world who are saying, you know, I always kind of intuitively did this, or I was always kind of the person in my friend circle who said, no, we should have more structure, or no, we should do it in a certain way. Hmm. And I finally read your book and I'm like, oh my gosh, I was doing this and now, and now I have permission to do this.
Right. Right.
Giving people permission to take a community by the reins in a way that's thoughtful and adds more meaning, right, to me is the most, is why at some level I wrote this book.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, this is my last question for you, though I feel like I could ask you a million more questions, but I'm going to be respectful of the structure of the time. if you could have one person, dead or alive, read your book, who would you want it to be?
You know, I think that in a strange, this might sound strange, but I actually, there are people I do not want to read this book, in part because this book is a tool. Mm-hmm. Right. It's a tool with a lot of power in it, which is how do you gather in a way that changes things? It's at some level, it's an agnostic tool. Like I'm saying, you decide the purpose, you decide the identity that you're gathering around. It can be used for evil or it can be good. Right. In the hands of ISIS, right. Mm-hmm. I don't want ISIS to create better gatherings.
Right.
So I'm really, you know, authoritarian regimes, you know, could use this as a handbook, right? There is deep power in this book. Right. It can be used for anything. And so for me, and this is more because these are my values, I think like the progressive movement, I think right now, Vice President Biden is our nominee, I think that the way to actually make people come alive and to remember what is good and what is not just good, but willing to fight for, is to think about how you actually structure your gatherings, how you structure your rallies, how you reinvigorate a country. And frankly, in a moment of corona, I think it's even more complicated. Like, I think one of the biggest questions of this time is how do we actually create a sense of belonging and forward motion to create structural change and more fairness in our economy when we're physically can't leave our homes? And I believe that there is a way, but we need to invent it.
I don't know. I don't like to play favorites, but that might have been the best answer to that question. And we've been doing this for a long time. That was really good. So everyone listening at home, again, this is Priya Parker. Her book is called The Art of Gathering. Priya also has a podcast called Together Apart that you guys can find anywhere you get your podcast, probably wherever you're listening to this, they have it. Priya, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I love getting people's both questions and also experiments and examples of how you're gathering. And so if you're listening and you have either questions or a future gathering that you're trying to figure out, or just a gathering that you've been to that was really cool or inspiring, please write me. You can find me at priyaparker.com and send me an email. You can sign up for our newsletter, but we really are inspired by you all and the things, the many ways people are deciding to gather now. So please let this not be a one-way conversation. I hope to hear from you all.
Okay. You're going to hear from me a lot too, just FYI. You're going to be like, enough,
please.
Tracy, enough, get a life. Well,
I welcome
you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tracy. And thank you for such lovely questions. It's actually, you asked a number of questions that I haven't answered or thought about before. So it's really a treat to be with you.
That makes my day. And everybody else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening today. And thank you to Priya for being our guest. I'd also like to thank Ashley Garland and Michelle Modigliano for their help setting up this interview. Remember, the Stacks Book Club is reading Trust Exercise by Susan Choi in April, and we will be discussing the book next week with Brandon Taylor on April 29th. Find everything we discussed on today's episode in the link in the show notes. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Remember to check out our newest partner, Libro.fm, and use the code THESTACKS at checkout. You'll get 3 audiobooks for the price of 1. And you'll get to rest easy knowing you're supporting your local bookstore. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirgis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.